On this episode of World Affairs, as President Trump makes his first state visit to India, we discuss U.S.-India relations. Hello, I'm Philip Yun, CEO of World Affairs. Our weekly broadcast is produced in partnership with KQED. It's made possible by the generous support of Chevron and TPG. Ray Suarez starts us off with some background.
Namaste Trump is how the Indian city of Ahmedabad is billing a rally with President Donald Trump and Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. This is not the first time the two leaders have shared a stage.
Good morning, Houston.
In September, tens of thousands of Indian Americans packed a stadium in Houston, Texas, cheering on the two populist leaders.
The President of the United States of America, Mr. Donald Trump. When I met him for the first time, he said to me, India has a true friend in White House.
The friendship could be helpful to Modi, who for the first time since he was elected 6 years ago has been facing widespread street protests against a perceived Hindu nationalist agenda. In August, Modi's government revoked the statehood of Jammu and Kashmir.
India has flooded Jammu and Kashmir with tens of thousands of extra troops and police. Phone lines and the internet have been blocked since Sunday.
A conflict-ridden territory that's been India's only Muslim-majority state.
Kashmir is claimed by both Pakistan and India, with the nuclear-armed neighbors controlling different sections of the state.
Then, in December, India's parliament, controlled by Modi's BJP party, passed a citizenship law that favors non-Muslim migrants.
I'm here because I find this act, the Citizenship Amendment Act, completely unconstitutional, anti-people, arbitrary, and against the basic feature of the Indian Constitution.
The European Union has condemned the resolutions, but the Trump administration has fallen short of taking a firm stance on the citizenship law.
The BJP and its coalition partners are leading by a long way. 347 seats.
And the BJP, after a strong election victory in 2019, has fared poorly in some recent state and local races, and India's economy is growing at its slowest rate in decades. Joining me in studio to help us better understand the state of India-U.S. relations is Tanvi Madan. She's director of the India Project at the Brookings Institution. Her latest book is Fateful Triangle: How China Shaped U.S.-India Relations During the Cold War. And you have to break down that title a little bit for us, Tanvi, because in a way that the title tells us what a lot of the book is about, that the bilateral relationship between India and the United States has always been affected by what outside powers are doing.
Absolutely. And you see that today as President Trump heads to India and the U.S.-India relationship. I mean, sometimes people think it's an exaggeration to say that they're closer than they've ever been. It's true for the U.S.-India relationship. And a huge reason for that is that the two countries today share some concerns about not the rise of China per se, but its behavior in the region and what its behavior might be doing to the rules-based order in Asia and the Indo-Pacific more broadly. And that convergence in China has been over the last few U.S. administrations, from the Bush administration onwards, very consistently been driving the U.S. and India closer together.
Is there a personal relationship at the core of this? Is there something between Narendra Modi and Donald Trump that's pulling things along? Or are there broadly American interests and Indian interests that line up in a way that they haven't before?
I think personal relationships help. They help for a U.S.-India relationship that is not as institutionalized as U.S. relations with a number of allies, for example. These two countries are still getting used to being close partners. And so I think it helps when there's leader-level prioritization and interest in the other country. I think Prime Minister Modi has also recognized that President Trump, in particular, pays a lot of attention to personal relationships. And so he's made an extra effort with President Trump to kind of understand where he's coming from, what he likes, what his personal interests are, whether or not he buys into the strategic framing that many administrations have had in Washington, that India is important for strategic, economic, and values-based reasons. Prime Minister Modi has made sure that President Trump at least sees that India is a winner in Trump speak in some ways, including in the economic sense.
Let's roll all the way back to the late 40s, because this was a tremendously important time for all three countries. The United States emerges from the Second World War, an unquestioned giant, the only major industrial power that isn't in rubble, and now a globe-straddling superpower. China sends Chiang Kai-shek and the nationalist government packing off to Taiwan and proclaims the People's Republic of China. And India, after more than a century, sends the British Empire home, becomes self-governing, and splits into two countries. I mean, this is a lot of history being packed into like 36 months.
Absolutely. And you just think about that time where just 1 year alone, something like 1949, you know, the year the People's Republic of China is established, that's also the year, the Soviet Union has another kind of nuclear test. That's also when, for India, it becomes clear that they have to think about what had been a buffer state between China and them, Tibet, that China might have designs on it that might take it over. And this is when, amidst all this going on, Prime Minister Nehru becomes the first Indian Prime Minister to visit Washington and meet with an American president. And he comes just a few days after the Truman administration thought they had lost China to communism. And so Nehru gets this huge welcome from the Truman administration. President Truman goes to the airport to receive him, takes along three cabinet members and an honor guard. And this was all to kind of essentially convey to Nehru that the U.S. was hoping that he would be a partner for the U.S. in Asia and the world more broadly. One of the things they had hoped, and you saw this in the headlines at the time, India was considered the hope for Asia, a counterbalance to China, a democratic contrast as well. There was this real hope that Prime Minister Nehru and India would stand with the U.S. In kind of this battle against communism, the Soviet Union, but also Soviet-backed China in Asia.
Well, let's move forward, because India does not sit still during all this time. India now riven with controversy because of a new law that says, yes, we will take in refugees from other countries in this region if they are, and they name a bunch of ethnic and religious origins, they will be able to settle and become Indian citizens. But if they are Muslim, no. And this has set off riots, set off street battles, set off endless controversy. What's going on in India?
So I think in understanding nationalism that you're seeing play out, and I think it's a one variant of identity politics that you're seeing globally now. Nationalism in India playing out is of two varieties. There's an Indian nationalism that Prime Minister Modi also kind of plays to. And frankly, in many ways, so did previous Indian governments. This idea that India, whose economy has been doing well for the last 10, 15 years, who's emerging on the global stage and the regional stage, has been getting a larger voice and has building its military capabilities and its reach around the world, that this India, what they call a re-emerging power, not an emerging power, because they will remind you that not that long ago, a couple of centuries ago, India contributed 25% of the world's GDP. This view holds that India is a re-emerging power and needs to show strength and needs to be taken seriously and needs a voice and a role on the world stage commensurate to Indian kind of power. That Indian nationalism is frankly has a wider base. There is that strain of Hindu nationalism, and that is something the BJP, parts of it, kind of readily will say that they're very much a Hindu nationalist party. Others might not like the term, but that is very much part of their base, who do think that, and this is a range, but at its kind of most extreme, the strain says that India should be a Hindu country, and others should accept that India is a Hindu country. Now, not all people who support Prime Minister Modi believe this, but it is a strain within the party. So I think there are these true strains of nationalism. And what you're seeing on the streets of India, they're not riots as such. What they are is often protests, students, women, others who are saying, look, we disagree with this. We disagree with the Citizenship Amendment Act. We have concerns about a potential national register of citizens. And so what you're seeing is across India, in very diverse forms, because it's a very diverse country, you are seeing protests within that democratic system. And this is where the fact that India has a strong civil society and a relatively free media, you are seeing these protests play out and push back against this law that was passed. And I think you're seeing it also, some of the pushback, saying that there isn't a consensus on this, that even though Prime Minister Modi won this huge majority not that long ago, less than a year ago, that there are not people happy about this. And I think you're seeing that in some of the recent state elections in India, where the Prime Minister's party has suffered some setbacks.
In some of the parts of India that have significant religious minorities, like Kerala, like Punjab, there's been a lot of resistance to this new Citizenship Act. Does it pull people together, stressing their Indianness rather than their Hinduness?
I think there are going to be different answers to that, because I think there are some people who do embrace their Hinduness. They don't necessarily think of that as distinct from Indianness. I think in some BJP supporters, some Prime Minister Modi supporters will sometimes say that we weren't allowed to be Hindu enough, or that previous governments, for example, pandered too much to Muslimness. But what you are seeing, I think, is in some ways it's bringing certain groups together, including the young and the old. You're seeing younger students who really weren't kind of energized about very much in terms of political advocacy coming out on the street, reading the Indian Constitution, the preamble to it, etc., on the streets. But you are also seeing, and I don't want to underplay that this is a very divisive issue. It will play out in India. It will play out in a very loud, boisterous fashion. It will hopefully play out peacefully on both the parts of the protesters and the law enforcement that is, tackling these protests. But I do think it can be, in some ways, it's unifying, but I think it is also divisive in ways that are taking up a lot of time, attention, and resources for the Modi government. But I think you're also seeing another kind of strain that has been developing over time. You're seeing how India is becoming, India's always on the books been a federal country. There's federalism in India. A number of states are saying, including some that are run by coalition partners of the BJP, they are saying we are not going to follow some of it. We object to this act. And so you're seeing some of the states band together. And it's not just kind of states where there are large minorities. It's just states who have parties who disagree with this kind of grand divisions.
Would it be overdrawing the parallel? Would it be reading too much into it to compare India to the way that in some countries in the West, there's been a fusing of national identity with Christianity? Look at Vladimir Putin's Russia, previously officially atheist state that has really embraced with both arms the Orthodox Church. The rise in a kind of Christian nationalism in the United States that's encouraged by very influential people in the country and the culture. Or Viktor Orban's Hungary, which is very much associating a sort of Western Christian cultural inheritance with what it means to be a Hungarian. Is it part of that same wind, or would it be a mistake? And is it particularly Indian in a way that resists that kind of drawing of a parallel?
I think you can see some similarities, and there's a broader question to be asked that even though this kind of identity issues, these nationalism issues, they're playing out in very different ways. There's a sense of loss. In the West, it tends to be of, you know, kind of the East rising, taking jobs, you know, changing culture, immigrants coming from outside. In countries like China and India, it's about regaining a lost past, whether that's, you know, religious or historical. But I think there are some things about India that do make it different. It is far more diverse than most countries where this is playing out. It is far larger. But also, its minority population is quite significant. So India, by any given count, has the second or third largest Muslim population in the world. But the other thing is, it's not just religious differences that exist in India. And that's not often the primary difference. Ethnic, linguistic differences sometimes play a bigger role. This whole Citizenship Amendment Act first came up from the fact that citizens in the state of Assam, and particularly those who are Assamese, and kind of an ethnic, tribal, linguistic, they have ethnic, tribal and linguistic identities that are different, that they didn't want, and they didn't care if they're Hindus or Muslim. They didn't want Bengalis who are from the state of West Bengal or Bangladesh to be coming there, taking their jobs, changing their culture according to them. And so I think in some ways, India is more complex. It's also, you know, pushing back in a much more kind of vigorous way, I think you're seeing in on the streets, but also kind of at the ballot box.
Similarly, would it be an overdrawn conclusion to draw parallels between Prime Minister Modi and President Trump in this way? And for instance, Trump has been relatively silent or close to completely silent over the Citizenship Act.
Well, I think some of it is some of the silence on the part of President Trump, but also his administration more broadly. They've been quite circumspect. Is two reasons, and I suspect you'd have seen a non-Trump administration perhaps take the similar view. One, they think India is too strategically and economically important to upset the relationship with. And second, and even President Obama held this view, is that sometimes you could actually convey things privately that would get taken more seriously than saying them publicly. I'm not sure President Trump will bring this up, but American officials have kind of expressed concerns about this act and how it might play out. They also care about what this does to Indian stability, its economy, its ability to actually play that balancing role against China that they want. But I do think, you know, the Trump-Modi comparisons, and I think there are kind of some similarities, yes, where they have kind of come to stage. They do think about these themes of populism and nationalism. But they're also quite different, not just as individuals. I mean, Prime Minister Modi comes from a background, he's fairly austere in many ways, but also comes from, you know, not an affluent background, not an elite background. He's actually been in politics for a number of years. He ran one of India's kind of largest states for over a dozen years. So they're quite different in some ways. And I think you see this, and Prime Minister Modi also, you know, he sweats the small stuff. He's a details guy. That's not what President Trump is. I think you've also seen that when Prime Minister Modi realizes that some of these themes, whether populism and nationalism, aren't working for him, he's been known to dial them back a bit. So in some ways, you could say he's more deliberate about these themes and how to use them. But that also means that if he decides to amp them up, he could probably do that more effectively.
American presidents often hit the road in the fourth year of a term to show that they are players on the world stage. On the other end, on the receiving end of these visits, are there people whispering in Prime Minister Modi's ear about whether or not there'll be a different president to deal with in 11 months?
I think they would have preferred that this doesn't become a political football in the U.S. I think they're going to be quite careful. There will be some concerns that President Trump, will he say something political? They will be careful. They have also made it a point during the Munich Security Conference. The Indian foreign minister made it a point to meet a number of the Democrat members of Congress who were there. So they're making it a point to kind of highlight that, look, we will work with whoever comes to power in Washington in November. What they will look at is, How does the next president think about Asia? How does it do they think about U.S. commitments? How do they think about the U.S. role in the world? But I think during the visit, Prime Minister Modi, despite being cautious about not letting this become a political event, it is nonetheless in some ways quite political in the sense that he's giving President Trump some clear visuals of over 100,000 people cheering him on that no doubt the Trump campaign will use as it did the last time Trump and Modi did a Howdy Modi in Houston.
I want to talk about Howdy Modi, but I also want to talk about what is facing Prime Minister Modi right now. After decades of really healthy growth, the Indian economy has slowed to its slowest rate of growth in decades. Does that put pressure on the Modi government in a way that it might not have been under during another presidential visit, to make some deals, to show people that there are some gains to be had from this bilateral relationship?
I think this the kind of slowing economic growth rate puts pressure on Prime Minister Modi, period, whether or not it's to do with the trip. Because at the end of the day, Prime Minister Modi came to office the first time around in 2014 and again in 2019, promising economic growth and jobs. What it does in terms of the trip is, I think that's part of what Prime Minister Modi gets out of this trip, because we've talked about kind of what President Trump gets out of it in terms of potentially some deals, particularly on the defense side, but also this kind of very high visual, high on optics trip. But I think for Prime Minister Modi, he will see this after a difficult couple of months, criticism from abroad, slowing economic growth rate at home. He will see this as kind of endorsement or a validation that, look, I have brought the most powerful man in the world to India. He has come to, in some ways, endorse our partnership, and not just the U.S.-India partnership, but kind of the Modi-Trump partnership. And one thing with Prime Minister Modi is, he has very actively campaigned in election campaigns, both state and national level, saying that one of the things he will deliver is respect on the world stage to Indian citizens. And he will use this as an example, with the crowds cheering on, the world's media there. This is an example of, look, yes, there might be setbacks. Hang in there with me. I have brought to the world to India.
Well, the United States has come pretty late to the Indian diaspora game. And now you see this tremendous self-confident, increasingly affluent, well-educated, and chest-thumping that is a new thing for us here in the United States and maybe a new thing for an Asian minority in the United States. Something like Howdy Modi was just remarkable. And the way he was received in other cities as he traveled through the United States. What should Americans looking on and not quite sure what it's all about know about that?
I think for one, Indian Americans, I think you've seen them kind of dive in to pretty much every segment, whether it's media, politics, business. Chinese Americans will ask, how come there are so many Indian CEOs of large American firms and they're not that many Chinese American ones? I think some of it is, this is a diaspora that in some ways is a natural fit here. English speaking, also the immigrants that came here tended to be from the professional classes, the doctors, the lawyers, the engineers, the professors, the techies. They're very comfortable in the democratic space. They understand diversity, loud, boisterous. But one thing that it's important for people to remember, it is also a very diverse diaspora. It is not just supporters of Prime Minister Modi. There are also people who don't agree with him. The generational differences between kind of first generation Indian Americans and others. After all, this is a community that, while they might turn out for kind of a Howdy Modi with President Trump there, a significant number, over 80%, the estimates are, voted for Hillary Clinton in the last election. They're heavily concentrated in blue states. And they tend to vote Democratic even in congressional races. Whether it's in terms of their politics or their religion, there are a lot of not just Hindu, but Muslim, Christian, Sikh, Parsis, and other Indian Americans. And the term sometimes is used model minority, which makes people kind of move back a little in the community, which is that, you know, there are a lot of Indian Americans who aren't kind of the ones you're seeing prominent, wealthy. There are folks who are not doing so well and could do, you know, just feel like they need some help as well. So I think it's a very diverse community, but I think it's one that feels that America has given them something that they weren't getting in India. But I do think they have helped be at least one bridge between the U.S. and India and feel very comfortable going back and forth. Their success is one reason, or the success of the community as a whole, and their comfort level. And as long as there's a sense in India that, look, that's a place people can succeed, that is something that gives the U.S. huge soft power in India that very few other countries can actually match.
Well, about one out of every six people on the planet lives in India. So if you like to think of yourself as a person who follows the news, you really do owe it to yourself to keep up with what's going on there. Fateful Triangle, How China Shaped U.S.-India Relations During the Cold War. Tanvi Madan, always good to see you.
Thank you, Ray.
You've been listening to World Affairs. We're more than a program. We're a nonprofit membership organization dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Please join our community and visit us at worldaffairs.org. World Affairs is produced in partnership with KQED. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. We had engineering help from Robert Frazier. Our producer is Jared Sport, and our executive producer is Joanne Jennings. I'm Philip Yun. Thank you for joining us.